When it comes to home insurance, GEICO works for you. And since I'm the GEICO Gecko, I work for you too.
Hey, Gecko, could you DJ my workout?
I got you, Derek. I know you like them sweet beats on leg day. Great home gym, by the way.
That's fire, Gecko.
I call this remix. Bundle your home and car insurance so you can save and get coverage that grows with you.
Oh, yeah. Rolls right off the tongue. And you know what else I like?
Air horn.
Oh, yeah.
Let Geico work for you. Get more with Geico.
12-year-old Lee Spencer is in the back seat of his family's car as it's pulling up the driveway of the house they are moving into. Lee notices a young girl looking at him from the upstairs window. No one else in the car sees her. This is the beginning of a 4-year journey of Lee Spencer's unbelievable events that happened in and outside of that house. Spencer's Ghosts, available now on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Apple, any place you get your books. Available in paperback and ebook.
Hello, paranormal fans. This is Mark Drotus, paranormal suspense author. Are you looking for a good scare? Something that will challenge your thoughts about ghosts and hauntings? If so, read The Haunting of Crimshaw Manor and find out what happens when a paranormal club investigates a mysterious haunted house where shadow figures are seen, screams heard, and an undeniable torment is revealed. The Haunting of Crimshaw Manor is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or wherever scary books are sold. And don't forget to listen to Ghost in the Valley podcast with Al Cooley. Both will give you chills and keep you up at night, night.
Hello and welcome to Ghost in the Valley podcast. I'm your host, Al Cooley. Today is the last show of 2024, and what a show it is. Actor, stuntman, Bill Little. I can't wait to dive into my questions with Bill, and we have a whole lot to talk about. And I'll be right back after these brief messages. Today on my show, I have Bill Little. Bill is a writer, director, and so much more. He's also the owner and CEO at Scott Films. Bill is from Glasgow, UK. I came across the Uninvited Spirit on social media. The poster for the movie grabbed my attention, and I said, I got to learn more about this, you know. And I contacted Bill, and he was so gracious to get back with me. And we're going to talk about the Uninvited Spirit. But first, welcome to the show, Bill.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
Yeah, well, before we get into the show, yeah, I had mentioned, the Uninvited Spirit, and we're going to get into that. But what led you into, I have down here writing, directing, acting, the whole nine yards, but let's start with writing. I mean, what got you into the writing process?
Oh, long story. I was 12 years in the army, and when I left the army, I was a kickboxer, professional kickboxer. I was lucky enough to win the world title 3 times. But then I got an injury and I had to retire. And then, you know, I was really by mistake. I was bored one day and I thought, you know, I would just write some things down about life in the army and what we had done. And I just, it was one of these things, I started writing and I couldn't stop. And that's, I wrote my first film, it was called Train to Kill, mostly about military, but I actually wrote it as a manuscript for a book. And I sent it to, maybe a dozen different publishers, and not one of them took it. I met a scriptwriter who actually worked for the STV, Scottish Television. And we got chatting, and I don't know why we got onto the subject of books, But I told him I'd written this, and he asked if he could read it. So, I mean, I put it in the bottom drawer, hiding out the way, and I let him read it. And he came back to me about 2 weeks afterwards, and he said, "Have you written anything before?" And I said, "No, why?" He said, "It's very good." And I thought, well, publishers don't seem to think so. And he said, "Why don't you write it as a script?" And I said, "I haven't a clue how to write a script." And he said, "Well, I'll help you." And I said, "Well, you're the script writer. Why don't you write it?" And he said, "No." He said, "When you write something, you probably know with being a writer, when you write something, part of the script that you write comes from inside you. And it's partly your experiences and what you've done in the past." So he said, no, if he was to write it, then it would all change. So he said to me, "I'll show you how to do it." And he did. And then, bang, it just took off from there. And I just get ideas all the time. And I just, any scrap bit of paper, I'll write something down on it. And then when I've got enough, I think, well, you know, I could write a script out of this. And that's just how I do it.
You know, your director and producer and actor. we'll get into that also. But, you know, I'm going to go back even further. I'm going to go back to, I said a little bit of a bio on you. And your father got you into boxing, you know, because you're interested in. And then you went into judo and karate. And, I mean, do you think, and I mean, I see that you're also a stunt coordinator and a stunt man. So I'm thinking, did you think that your judo and your boxing, your experience helped you in your stunts?
Oh, yeah, very much. I like when I do any fight scenes, my name obviously goes on to it. And there's, although I've retired from martial arts a long, long time ago, I still have a lot of friends in martial arts. And... well, I call them friends, but they're the worst ones because they're very critical. And so when I do fight scenes, I like to try and make it as realistic as I can without the actors getting hurt. I mean, they might sort of get a punch in the face or maybe a couple of bruises here and there, but I try and train them, spend weeks and weeks training them, rehearsing it all. There's always the X factor that something will happen. But I rely on the martial arts background. And it helps with stunts as well, because it also teaches you a lot of safety first. But the idea, of course, is no one gets hurt. But if I can use sort of techniques from judo, aikido, boxing, karate, it makes it more interesting for the audience. It makes it different. I'm not talking about like the old kung fu movies, right? People like Bruce Lee, Chuck Norris, they're the people who sort of made it more interesting, because the techniques they used were all different. I would say actually that it leads on to the modern MMA fighters, because they don't just stand there in a normal karate stance or a judo stance and get hold of one. They can do groundwork, they can do kicks, they can do punches, they can do grappling. So it makes it a lot more interesting, and it makes the fights more realistic. I also tend to get them to use whatever they can as well. Pick up a bottle, hit someone with it, or a bit of wood that's lying there, and hit, not real enough, hit someone with it. Again, because it makes it more realistic. In a fight, you will use anything. Anything to defend yourself or your family, you will pick up and use it. So I tend to use things like that as well.
Yeah. Would you say, like, during your stunt career, what has anything come to mind that maybe you thought, well, maybe this is a little bit too far, you know, more scarier than, say, another scene? Actually, maybe what did I get myself into?
Yeah, one in particular. We have a program here. It was worldwide, so you've got it in America. It was called Taggart. And I had to do a stunt where I was going through sort of the dockyards on a motorbike, getting chased. And the idea was, when I get to the end of the pier and there's nowhere to go, so they actually forced me to the end of the pier, and riding the motorbike off the pier into the Clyde. It's massive, big sort of, well, massive big river. And I thought, right, okay. And we rehearsed it. Went perfect. Then, me being stupid, I came up with the idea of extending the pier, but build it with balsa wood, which is soft wood, and any bit of weight on it, it just all collapses.
Uh-huh.
But because it's soft wood, if it hits you, it wouldn't hurt you anyway. And I had full leather gear, biker gear on, I had crash helmet and everything on. So that was okay. So we said, right, okay, we'll build this, get it done. There was a couple of divers in the Clyde River. They were there, you know, waiting in case anything would go wrong. So it came to do the stunt and went great. Got chased along the pier, got onto the balsa wood, it all collapsed, went into the water. And when you're doing a stunt like that, what you do is when you're coming down into the water, you throw the bike away from you. And that way it doesn't land on top of you, it doesn't injure you. As I went to throw the bike away, the stirrup on it where you put your feet, it caught into my leather trousers, ripped all the trousers up, and ripped all my calf open. I had to learn to walk. It burst every blood vessel in my calf.
Wow.
It ripped the tendons in half. And they told me I would end up walking with a limp. Lucky enough, about 6 months later, on crutches and good medical care and the doctors, I was okay. But I attended, not to do too many motorbike stunts after that, or come up with good ideas.
Yeah, probably driving your wife crazy too, you know, you go home and...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
She got to worry about that, you know.
Yeah. She, actually, that's why I gave up doing stunts now. I do the fight arranging, but a lot of the other stunts, I just gave up doing them now because it's too much on the family.
Right, you know, being a coordinator is a whole lot better, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's good when you can tell people what to do.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah, you you put the whole new meaning in, go break a leg, you know.
Well, a lot of people, they've got this idea that stunt people, not just stunt men, you know, stunt women and everything, they've got this idea that they must be crazy. But there's a hell of a lot of safety involved in it. There's a lot of checks done, and you always sort of work with something you trust, especially like doing fire stunts. You've got to rely on your partner to look after you. It's like a buddy-buddy system.
Uh-huh.
But as I say, there's always that little X factor that you've got to be careful of. Doesn't matter how much training you do, how much rehearsals, you've got to be aware that just something might just go wrong.
Yeah, no, I was in the video production for about 20 years. I had my own production company, and I know just, you know, firsthand, and I'm nowhere near the caliber where you're at, but I mean, finding the talent for the one documentary I did on True Ghost Stories. So finding the talent that I wanted for each story, the audio and the video and the makeup and the whole nine yards, you know. But it always came down to the bottom line was the cost. You know, what it cost to put these things on. You know, and I'm on a low budget. When you say low budget, that was my entire life savings, you know. So yeah. Luckily I have a wife that hasn't divorced me yet. And has she has stood behind me on all my crazy adventures, you know. But yeah, I was going to get to that with you making films. I mean, I know it's hard. Like I had down here, you know, the easy part's making the film. You know, the hard part is getting the marketing and the financial backing to put that puppy out. You know, would you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, nothing's easy, but the marketing's really hard. What I would say to people is try and use all the social media that they can. Ask all their friends and their family and help to advertise it. You know, a lot of the young independents that's just starting up or people that are leaving college, I feel a little bit sorry for it. I'm quite lucky. I've got a reputation, so I can bring in some money.
Uh-huh.
Most of it, well, my bank manager doesn't like me. Most of it I have to fund myself and then just believe that you're going to get it distributed, you're going to get it marketed. And what I normally do, if it does make any profits, that after paying all the cast and the crew, if it makes a profit, what I like to do is not put half of it back into the bank and pay the creditors back. And then the other half, I can use that as a start to do the next film.
Yeah, that's what like my wife was saying, you know, we put all this money into like camera gear and audio gear and media. I did my own editing and software. And in my music career, you know, I also guitars and amps and sound system production and producing and recording, you know. And then I get into my book, you know, like you said, you know, you reach out to traditional publishers and you've been rejected so many times. So I went into self-publishing, well, that means putting in more of my money, you know. So, yeah, I'm still waiting for that great big return back. But but you have to do what you have to do what you love to do. You know, you have to...
That's it.
You're not sitting on your butt and expecting it to come to you. You know, you have to work for it.
Yeah, I mean, I love being on set. It's just, for me, personally now I like directing. It's not so stressful.
What would you prefer in, like working on a set, directing, producing, or designing, cinematography? Or
definitely the directing.
Mm-hmm.
It's because it's not so stressful behind the camera, and I can visualize everything, and it's, you know, I did some acting, but when you're directing, you can interact with the cast, and I think I'm in a better position because I've been behind the camera and I've been in front of the camera, so I try and use that to get the best out of the actors, and I'd sort of give the actors more leeway than another director would.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they have a script there, but... As far as I'm concerned, a script is just a guideline for them. If they want to change maybe some of the dialogue, so long as it works in with the scene and so long everybody knows what the changes are, then I just let them go for it. A good position, especially if it's a film that I wrote, then I don't have to go and speak to a writer. But definitely, yeah. I mean, I love to see the end product when it's all edited and the music's put together.
Yeah, the sound effects and the scenery.
Yeah, when everything's, it's brilliant. And then you can sit there and you can say, well, I told them how to do that. I directed that. You know,
uh-huh.
To me, it gives me more satisfaction than just, I mean, an actor goes on set, he does his acting role and then he goes home.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But if you're directing it, once you're away home, you're still up. Looking at the takes for that day, you're sitting with the editor, you're telling the editor how you want it put together. You know, it's a long, long day, but it's worth it in the end when you see the completed thing on screen.
Yeah, like me, you know, I directed it, my documentary. I directed it, produced it, did the casting, the whole nine yards, you know, and then, like my wife said, why couldn't you be like a DJ? You know, you play your music and you're done for the night, you know. But you have to do all this editing. Even I was doing weddings, I was videotaping weddings. And I was like, my job's not done at the end of that wedding. You know, I still got 2 weeks of editing of 10 or 12 hours of footage, you know, multi-camera shots, you know. And, of course, you know, you know what I'm talking about.
I'll be right back with my conversation with Bill Little.
I was coming across more of your bio, was interested in one series you were in, Extreme Justice. How did that come about?
Extreme Justice, well, actually, I actually wrote it as a, we had a pilot film, and then we had 8 episodes, but like we were speaking about earlier, we ran out of money.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did... The pilot film and the first episode, we put both of them together. We shot the first episode, picked the best parts out of them all, and then I wrote another 5 new scenes to sort of tie it all together and make it sort of more sensible. And we put it all together and put it out as a film. And lucky enough, there's an American company called RM Entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And they liked it. And they took it, and it's on their channel. It's worldwide on their channel. As far as I know, you can watch it on everything basically.
Yeah, I was trying to download that the other day. I couldn't find it. So I was going to ask you, where can I get that at? You know, to watch that.
Oh, RM Entertainment. You can Google RM Entertainment, and You have to register onto the site.
RM?
RM. R for Robert, M for Michael, and then it's entertainment.
Oh, okay.
You register free. It doesn't cost you anything. You register free onto their site, and then like they have like horror, science fiction, mm-hmm. and what you do is you scroll down until you come to British TV.
Which I love.
well, there's quite a few different things on it. But if you scroll along, you will see Extreme Justice. And all you do is you click on to play, and you can watch it.
Is it a film, or is it like a miniseries?
No, it's actually a film.
Oh, okay. All right.
As a matter of fact, I'm glad you asked that question, because, as I say, I wrote sort of 8 episodes, and we've only used 1 and a bit. So I thought, I still get like 6 episodes there. So because it's had a lot of views, and I thought, well, you know, I'm going to do a follow-up to it after New Year.
Oh, awesome.
And I'm just going to use, piece together some of the bits out of the other episodes and just make another film out of it. And again, I'll be sending it to RM Entertainment.
I see that you have a very interesting life. I'll say that. you went to Spain,
yeah.
Philippines. I can't think of all of them, but
I've been around.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, what led you? And you even took your Scott Films to Spain. I mean, was that a planned move or?
Nope.
Okay.
We'd actually shot half of the, Train to Kill film. We'd already shot half of it in Scotland, and then we had some really bad weather. But we'd actually been looking to emigrate over to Spain. We actually found a house there that we liked, and we thought, right, we'll go over and we'll see this house, get all the legal stuff sorted out. And then we thought, well, you can't just live in Spain and do nothing. So we bought a bar.
Okay.
a bar come restaurant sort of.
So you're a jack of all trades, I'll tell you that.
Well, I didn't do any of the cooking or nothing. I served. I'd done my barman and waiter. So then, once we get settled there and the bad weather and all that had cleared up, we now found that we had a house in Spain, we had a business in Spain, but the film was, half of the film has already been shot in Scotland. So I thought, what can we do? So, I'll not give away too much about it, but I rewrote a scene where the hero's wife is captured by the Spanish mafia. They're over here doing a deal mm-hmm. with the UK sort of gangsters, and it all goes wrong, and the hero's wife happens to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, so they kidnap her, and then she's accidentally killed in a crossfire by the Spanish mafia.
Mm-hmm.
The hero of the film is a former sergeant in the SAS, Special Air Service.
Uh-huh.
So he decides, he thinks the police are not doing enough, so he decides to go to Spain, and he goes after the Spanish mafia himself. He has a friend, an old sort of Special Forces friend, who sort of works for the MI6 in Spain. Mm-hmm. And he helps them get the contacts and everything in Spain. And that's how we change things around to give like a good reason for the hero to go to Spain. And I must say, the Spanish were brilliant with us. We even got a submarine.
Oh, wow.
We got a submarine.
Oh, wow. That's impressive, man.
Yeah. A friend of a friend over there had a speedboat. Something like we've got a lot of James Bond scene where they're escaping a speedboat, yeah. shooting at the mafia who's on the pier shooting at them.
Yeah.
They were great with us, you know. And then lucky enough, when I finished that film, there was a British company that were actually shooting in Spain, right below. Well, we were based in the marina, the pub, the bar was based in the marina, which was right below us. And one day we noticed a lot of camera crew and sound crew and all that, and me being me and being nosy, I thought, I'm going to go down and see what this is. I went down, and it turned out that one of the stuntmen on it was someone that I knew.
Oh.
So he introduced me to the director on it, and I ended up as the assistant director on this other film.
Well, you just fell right into that, right?
Yeah, so, and then we invited him up to the bar later on that day, and they used the bar as a location in the film. I think I'm just one of these lucky people that I'm in the right place at the right time.
I was just going to say that. Mm-hmm.
But I ended up, I lived in Spain for 4 years, and then I came back to UK.
Well, I see that, you know, you're an international writer, an actor, a director, a production assistant. I mean, that's a really an understatement because, you know, I see you also built a house in the Philippines. So did you split your time between Scotland and the Philippines, correct? Am I wrong there?
No. My wife's actually Filipino.
Oh, okay.
So we decided that we bought land there. We bought the land. This was supposed to be for when I retire.
Okay. So I don't see that coming anytime soon.
Oh, no. We bought the land in the Philippines quite close to where her parents and her sister family live. The Filipinos, they're very family-orientated. You know? So we decided this land was up for sale near the family, so we bought the land and we built, well, the Filipinos call the house a mini-mansion.
Oh, okay, yeah. Uh-huh.
So we bought this house. We've had the house for 8 years now. We decided that, as I say, it was supposed to be my retirement because it's a lot cheaper to live in the Philippines than what it is here. And the weather is a lot better than what it is here, apart from the rainy season because they get a lot of typhoons. It's not bad because the wife's mum and dad, they have sort of a big brick house. Like her sister has a little house, believe it or not. The bedroom is wooden. The rest of it is made of stone, but the bedroom's wooden. So when it's bad weather or the typhoons are on, my sister-in-law and her family come to our house and they stay in our house until it's all settled. But as I said, the best thing I ever did. Filipinos, they might be poor, but they're very kind. And when I first went to the village, I was the only white person there. But now, I mean, everybody knows me.
British, like British royalty, you know.
Yeah, well, one time there was a really, really bad storm, a bad typhoon, I should say, really bad, and it flooded a lot of it. And as you said, some of the poor people, the houses are made like of corrugated metal or wood, and a lot of them all collapsed and everything. So what I did, I advertised here and I spoke to some of my friends. We got some money together. I think it was 40,000 pesos we raised. And I sent it over to the wife and she got little plastic bags, like, and she bought like rice and chocolate, tin food, things that they would need. And she got them all to come to her house and she gave them all a bag each. Ever since then, I mean, everybody knows me now over there. Yeah. I didn't do it, no. I just felt sorry for the people. Mm-hmm. And I knew that if we could get this, they couldn't afford it.
Yeah.
So if I could get this money together, at least we could give them some food and
right.
sort of
help them out.
And yeah, so.
Do you still have a house in the Philippines?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we still have it there. And we're still building.
Oh, still building? Yeah.
I still have. Well, we bought the land next to us. And I don't know, you probably don't know what it is, but we bought these little baby trees, and the fruit that they're on is called calamansi.
Mm-hmm.
And the Filipinos love this calamansi fruit. They use it to make sauce.
I heard about that, but I never had it, you know.
Right. So we bought, I think it was 270 of these little baby trees. Now these trees are about 8 foot high.
Oh, okay.
And they have the calamansi fruit on them. It takes sort of 18 months to 2 years. And next month is the first time we'll be able to sell them. And what they actually do, the buyers sort of come and they'll pick whatever it is, we wait, give it to them, then they sell it to the market stall holders, and then they come back and they pay us. So it's a little business we've got going there. And we also have another little one where it helps the people as well, that we buy. At the moment, I think it's 25 sacks of rice, because the Filipinos, they eat rice for breakfast, lunch, dinner.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
So I think it's like 25, yeah, that 25 sacks of rice we buy. And it's like a loan of a sack. They'll come to us, we give them a sack of rice, and then they've got a month to pay us back. And of course, we make a little profit on what they pay us back. And then what we do is we use that to buy another 25 sacks. And then they've got another month to pay us back. So they're getting a sack of rice and they have a month to pay us. And that's a wife's wages. I don't see that. But it keeps her happy. It keeps them sort of fed because they know they're going to get that office every month and they've got a month to pay us back.
Now, your wife being Filipino, does she like the Philippines? Would she prefer to be in the Philippines or Scotland?
The idea, well, supposed to have. She comes here, stays here for 5 years, gets a job here for 5 years to get, that was just going to bank as savings. And then the both of us would go back to the Philippines permanently.
Okay.
But.
yeah, that was the idea, yeah.
Yeah, it is very, very, very difficult. I don't know why, but it's very, very difficult for the Filipinos to get a visa.
Right.
To come here. For, it's okay, to get a holiday visa, even then it's a bit difficult with the things that they have to do. But to get a visa to become permanent here, it's really, really difficult. And as usual, it costs. It's not cheap. But hopefully next year, we're counting next year, she's going to come here permanent.
I was going to get into now the uninvited spirit.
Right.
Without giving too much away, what is this movie about?
Whoa. Right. I have to refer to my notes now.
Okay.
I'd never done a horror movie before. Most of my movies are all sort of action movies. So someone was talking to me and they were going on about horror movies and they were saying horror has got a very big fan base.
Oh, it does. Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, why not try something different? So, and then I started researching and I started watching a lot of horror movies. And then I thought, what can I do that's not been done before? Horror movies have done everything. They've had slasher movies, they've had murders, they've had the ghost stories, the comedy. They've done every type of genre you could think of.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, I'll have to do something different on this. So it's more like a psychological horror.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it still gets some horror in it. But I wanted people saying, you get it all the time, you probably don't know. They watch a scene, and as I say, there's that many different genres that horror's done. They watch a scene, and then they know, they say to themselves, I know what's going to happen next.
That's my wife.
Uh-huh. And usually they're right.
Right? You know? I'm totally wrong. She's always got it right, yeah.
Well, what I thought I would do, I would make it so as people say, I know what's going to happen next, but it doesn't. I thought, I'm going to change it so they're expecting something to happen, and it doesn't happen. No. So it keeps them guessing
what's
going to happen.
Like you said, you got to bring something different to the table, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And it's like two different movies because the first half of it is mostly all horror. One of the things that happens is, you see all these films, they're usually in a haunted house or some cave in the woods or something, and they don't get out, they don't get away, they don't escape. Well, in Mines, they do get away. And it's about four college students. And what they do is they go to this old cinema and they're actually looking to see if they can find anything of value. Unfortunately, not unknown to them, there's an evil spirit in the place.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they actually rescue this evil spirit, not knowing. So they actually escape from this cinema with the help of another student. This other student, he's studying supernatural, so he knows all these incantations and phrases and everything, and he actually helps them to escape. So they think that's it, they've got away, nothing's happened, they're nice and safe, back in college, all students again. But what happens is the four students actually start to kill each other.
That alone is intriguing, you know. You've got them pitted against each other.
Yeah.
Now, do you star in this film?
I'm actually playing the police inspector in it. That was the next part. because of these murders and the students that's left, they're suspected by the police. They get took into the police station. They're interviewed, but of course, the police don't have any evidence. They can't prove anything. So I'm actually playing a police inspector who thinks, no, there is something into this. So he starts believing. I'm not sure how many students are still alive, but he starts believing them, and he decides to try and help them and try and find out what is actually happening and what's causing this. So it's actually, I suppose you could say it's like two parts in a film. The first part sort of horror, and the second part is more psychological with what is happening to these students, and it's all in the mind and what's making them do these things.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, me being me, there's a little bit of action in it as well.
Well, yeah, you got to have that stunt coordinator mentality also, you know.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
The action part, you know.
Yeah, it's mostly fight stuff, but I think it was a surprise a lot of people. I've actually used a cast in it that are unknown.
And that's always good, too. You know, you can unknown actor. I couldn't tell you how many movies I watched on BritBox, so I never heard of these people, you know. And I love those movies, and I just curious, like if you played in that, if you played the role, or you just behind the scenes, and you answered that, so that's cool.
Yeah, I think I'm a little bit. Remember, Alfred Hitchcock, he always gave himself a little part in every one of his movies.
Yeah, yes, you're right. Mm-hmm.
I try to do that as well. I usually it's just a smaller part, but I've actually. When I spoke to some people, they said because you're using a lot of unknowns, give yourself a bigger part in it.
What made you come up with a horror movie? I mean, what led you in that direction?
I just wanted to do something different rather than do the action.
Okay.
I'm not joking when I say I'm a wee bit concerned about doing another horror movie because we actually did the old cinema that we were in. It was 18-something. And actually, I mean, your listeners will probably not believe this, but we actually filmed some scenes, and then we went back, and when it came to editing it, we could hear voices.
Uh-huh.
And they fiddled about with the sound, and actually you could hear a voice, and it was a woman's voice, well, a young girl's voice, and it was telling us to get out. And I thought, what?
Yeah, you wouldn't believe in how many of these I hear, you know, like, so it amazes me, you know.
It is. I mean, there was a prop that one of the actors used. It's in the scene with him all the time. And when we were leaving set, I know that we took it with us because it was me that put it into the bag, the props bag. And then we put it into the van. And then the next day we were done and set, nobody could find this prop. And it wasn't in the van or nothing. So we ended up, we had to get another prop made up. And then 2 days later, we went back to the set. And when you go back in, you open the front doors, and then there was like stairs go up. And what's sitting on the stair? The prop. 3 days it was missing. And we all thought, oh, this is a joke, this is a wind-up. But everybody turned around and said, no, we never touched it. We never knew. And I know for a fact that it was in the bag and I put it in the van. So nobody can explain that.
Yeah, where are you looking to put this up, find a buyer for this, or?
Looking to get a distribution deal for it. I know that RM Entertainment will take it, but I would like to get sort of other distribution deals for it because actually, without sort of being big-headed right now, I think it's actually going to be a good film, and we're already, the way it ends, I always leave the ending open for doing a follow-up, and I'm hoping to do a follow-up to this one sort of next year.
My first book I just released, you know, I left the room at the end for a sequel.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you always do. I mean, if people are interested, then it's curiosity.
Yeah, I don't know if you're like an independent filmmaker, you know, if you had like a GoFundMe or a how do people, can they help fund it or?
Yeah, well, we're actually, to say after New Year, I'm hoping to do the sequel for the Extreme Justice and the sequel for the Uninvited Spirit.
And yeah, I was just going to ask you about, and I forgot to ask you about the Extreme Justice. I was going to ask you if there was if that was still going on.
Yeah, it's still on RME, the RM Entertainment. It's still on there. They can watch it on there. It doesn't cost them anything. It's free to watch. And as I say, you can watch it on your phone, your laptop, your TV. I think it's Apple Plus you can watch it on as well.
Okay, cool. I'm gonna look for it. I was looking for it the other day and I couldn't come across it. And I was like, I want to watch this movie.
But we're always looking for investors. I mean, if any of the listeners are interested,
I'm gonna put the links on the bottom of this episode so they can go to invest if they want to, or donate to the cause. You know.
Well, we've got a website. It's actually Scott Films UK. That's all one word. It's dot Wix site, WIXSITE.com. That's a website, but they can also email me, scottfilmsuk@gmail.com, or they can get us on Facebook, Official Bill Little.
Okay, you know, I want to put those links in the bottom of the episode so they can go and see what's coming up. You know, what do you have coming up? I mean, I know you say you're working on the Extreme Justice, and I know you're busy. Now, is the uninvited guest, is that work done now, or are you still working on that?
No, that's all edited now.
It's in the wraps? Okay.
Yeah, it's actually called movierights.com. They're actually based in Royal Palm Beach, Florida.
Okay.
She's acquisition and a distribution for Kalingo TV, but that's worldwide, and you can choose what countries you want them to distribute, and that's if they accept it. Extreme Justice, I just sent them the trailer, sent them the full film for them to watch, and they're going to get back to me tomorrow or Friday. And if they take it, then I mean, it's a worldwide sort of distribution deal with them.
That would be great, wouldn't it?
And I'm going to do the same with the Uninvited Spirit tomorrow. I'll send them the video, the full film. I just got a little bit of tweaks to do on it for the editing, but I'll send it to them tomorrow. I'll send them the trailer.
Yeah, I would love to put my book into a script, you know, like for a movie script, you know, for... and I had somebody... offer me, and that wasn't for a movie, it's for doing like like private theaters across the country, right, playhouses. Mm-hmm. and the guy has like 15 or 20, and he's in, and I ever offered me a small amount, and I don't know if I want to go that route or not, because then now they own my book, they own my story, you know. So I have to look at other, because this is new to me. My first book, my first novel, and it's based, my story is based on a true ghost story. Growing up in a haunted house, you know.
Right.
So I want to make
it. You grew up in a haunted house?
I did, yes.
Whew.
Yeah, so that's what my book's written about. His name is Lee Spencer in the book, which is actually me. You know, right. So it's written through my eyes. Which, that was hard to do, you going back 50-some years ago. And so I'm in past tense, but I want to go present tense.
I'll be right back with more of Bill Little right after these brief messages.
Believe it or not, I'm actually coming to America next year.
Where at?
It's actually a TV series, and I've got a recurring action role in it. Yeah, it's called The Gateway. Yeah, and that's with Raman Martin Productions. And I'm actually playing, believe it or not, we hear this, I'm playing a sort of a vampire priest.
Okay.
But the name gives it the Gateway. It's basically these sort of vampires, they've got a gateway where they can go into the past, the present, and the future. And it starts off like in the Viking times, and then it comes sort of, things happen. But I'm actually a good vampire, believe it or not.
Oh, okay.
But I'm really looking forward. I've never played a vampire before.
Do you know where that's being shot at, or...?
Yeah, I've got that written down as well. New Orleans.
Oh, okay. I've been there a couple of years ago, yeah.
From what I've seen of New Orleans, I've seen, there's a lot of sort of horror films and all that done there.
that's a very active town for spirits. That's why, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, mm-hmm. Right. We might see some real ones then. But yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I mean, they've done quite a lot of things. Rahman Martin Productions actually own RM Entertainment.
Oh,
TV
really?
Channel.
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. Lisa Lee Martin, she's the sort of owner, and she's directing this as well. And I met Lisa Lee lots of years ago. She was actually a songwriter.
Yeah, you'd be surprised on people that are connected through music or on how these connections work.
She was doing a European tour, her band at the time, her group, and she was in Scotland, and I got to meet her, and I was doing Train to Kill. And just off the cuff, I just said to her, oh, why don't you write a song for Train to Kill? And she wrote two songs that were used in the film. And that's how I got to meet her. And then she sort of went back to America. I don't know what happened, but then she graduated into film production. And now she's got her own TV channel. She's writing scripts. I think this is the second or third thing that she's directed. Lucky enough, she remembered me, and she sent me a message, and she offered me this, I can't say what role as I'm playing and the name, but she offered me this role, and she sent me the script, and I thought, The Gateway, and I read it, and I thought, Christ, that's a really good script, and it's a recurring role in it, because it's going to be I've got to be in every episode, because I'm one of the sort of, well, I'm a good vampire, I'll say that much about it. But I was amazed that I'm going to be a priest as well.
Well, that's a flip coin on the other side of that coin, you know.
I start off as a Viking.
A Viking, okay.
And I'm not going to say, I'm not allowed to say, but somehow I get turned into a vampire, and then it goes like to the present, and I'm a priest. But I'm a priest who knows when the bad vampires are coming, and I think I'm supposed to try and stop them.
I don't know why I'm hitting a brain fart here, like a Train to Kill. I think I've heard that before. Not Train to Kill. The Gateway.
Yeah, I looked it up. There has been a couple of things called The Gateway, but that's not unusual. I mean,
right.
But I think it's had this has been talked about since away last year. You probably have heard of it.
Mm-hmm. Alright, Train to Kill, did you write that one too?
Yeah, that was actually the first movie I did.
Oh, you had mentioned that, I'm sorry. Yeah, Train to Kill, that was...
It actually went out on DVD and everything.
Train to Kill.
Yeah, that was done about, believe it or not, 8 years ago.
Oh, wow, okay. My apologies.
No. It done pretty, I mean, it broke even. We sold a lot of DVDs for it, and of course in Spain and UK. And believe it or not, Germany as well. There's a lot of good sales there. But I actually wrote one called The Fighter, but I sort of shelved that. Then I started on Train to Kill, then I done Extreme Justice, now I've got The Uninvited Spirit. I've already written a follow-up to Extreme Justice.
Yeah, I got that down on my notes now to watch Extreme Justice and Train to Kill now. You know, so I want to check those two out. And
I've actually got another three scripts. One of them is my baby. One of them is called Realm of Darkness.
Oh, that sounds interesting.
By the title, you see, it's a bit of a horror, supernatural thing, but it would cost a lot of money to do it. There's a lot of like CGI.
Oh, right.
There's a lot of effects and everything in it. So what I'm trying to do is, if I can get sort of investors invested in these films, get them interested enough that they'll invest in the big one.
Right.
So I'm quite lucky because I know in Hungary, in Budapest, there's the biggest studio there, and I know the owner. I've got a deal with him. I can get it a lot cheaper, and of course it's cheaper to shoot there for cast and crew. I can get it all from him, all the one place. But again, it takes money.
Yeah. That's the bottom line, is getting that money to get it out there. I know for myself, you know, it was it took almost my whole life savings just to this little documentary. And it did end up winning like the small film festivals, a couple of them in the area. And I was surprised because sometimes you don't give yourself enough credit, you know. And that was me. I was like, I shouldn't be in this with a lot of these movies, you know. And I was like, oh, and they said, yeah, this is really good. You know, I don't know if they liked it because it was more of a like a B movie, you know. It's
it won an award, so that's that's proof that it was good. Mm-hmm. It's like your book. I mean, I know what you're saying about to do a screenplay from a book. Uh-huh. I would prefer to read a book because when you're doing a screenplay, you have to pick out scenes from the book. You can't
add in and take out, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can do the full book, and you would end up doing maybe 4 or 5 films just based on the book. So they can only take out sort of certain bits, certain passages or certain chapters of the book to turn into the film. And a lot of people don't like that, because, especially if they've read the book, because they think, oh, wait a minute, what happened at this part and why didn't they put this part in?
Right, so like if you like Stephen King, you know, you read...
Stephen King, brilliant.
You know, like you read a book and then you watch the movie.
Yeah,
watch the film. Oh, yeah. They took that part out, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I guess that's a business, you know.
Well, that's it. I mean, actually, on The Uninvited Spirit and Train to Kill, they both have their own pages on Facebook, and the trailers for each of them is on Facebook as well.
I know. I loved the poster for that. That was pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's
cool. I don't know who came up with that, but that was very attractive.
He's actually a Scottish guy who lives in New Zealand, and he's a good John Crooks. And the name of his company is Rosa Graphics. John's dad was in the army with me. That's how I got to know him. And John's brilliant. I just tell him what the film's about, and he just comes up with these great posters.
You know, they always say, you know, you can't judge a book by its cover. I don't know if I agree with that. You know,
no, I don't.
There's a lot of, a lot of times it's your promotion, your marketing, mm-hmm. You know, it means everything.
If it's visual, then people get interested in it.
You might have a fantastic movie, but if it's not marketed right, you know.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why I, what is it called? TikTok.
Right, mm-hmm.
I mean, I never ever bothered with TikTok. And then it was a friend of mine who's one of the TikTok sort of, I mean, he's got like a million fan base, and said to me, actually, get it onto TikTok. I said, what? I said, Uninvited Spirit. Just put up a couple of little clips, put up the trailer, and you'd be amazed. And I was. The trailer, we'd done 2 trailers, and the first trailer put up, within 2 weeks, it had over 1,000 hits.
Yeah, that's done amazing.
And I thought, bloody hell, that's better than YouTube.
Right, you know, and I'm an old fart myself, you know, so I'm a boomer. So for me to get into the TikTok, you know, I was like, I'm still trying to learn myself. When I got into the video production, I'm talking about VHS, you know, 16 millimeter.
16.
You know, so now we're talking. Then you go into DVD and then Blu-ray and then 4K streaming, and now there's even 8K and. I mean,
there's that much.
It's passing by, you know.
Actually, I think streaming is the thing for the future.
I think so.
For independents, because a lot of the cinemas, they're closing down. And you can't get a gap in the cinema, because like say MGM, Fox and all that, they book up all the space. Even if they've not got a film to fill that particular space, they know that by the time it comes to that space, they're going to have a film ready to put in there. So it's very difficult for an independent to get films in, unless you get a good distributor. So I think the way to go is through streaming.
Yeah, there was a place in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, a few years ago I went to, and I loved it, you know, because it was all independent. So they brought in independent films, some independent, and like the music. So the soundtrack for that play. They would go in and they would have a band playing the soundtrack.
Live,
right? So you had a live band, you had live performance, and it was independent writing. So I loved it, you know, but and it naturally didn't last long because it takes money, you know, to do all that.
But it's some atmosphere if it's all live.
Yeah, and to me that was, and I love off the wall shit. I mean, that's just me. I like off the wall stuff that just, my wife says I'm so weird, you know, but I like weird things, you know, I like things that's,
different.
It's different, and you promote it differently, and you can, well, you, like you said, you have to be different in your filmmaking.
Yeah, you have to be.
You have to bring something different to the table to, because people don't want the same, to watch the same old, you know.
Mm, that's right. I mean, you could even go as far to create your own sort of stories to market.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Because, as I say, if you put something different out there, or if it's something visually, people are going to want to see it. They're going to say, well, what's this? I mean, this, there used to be a thing about if you're making movies, you need an A-list star in it to sell. I don't believe that's true.
Mm-hmm.
You could get an A-list star in a movie, and the movie bombs.
Right. Uh-huh. Or you
if the storyline's not good.
Oh, right, or if you have so many known actors, you know, and you've seen that before. Yeah, you have like 10 main actors in a movie, and the movie sucks.
If the storyline's good, people will watch it.
Uh-huh.
If the storyline's good, if your acting's good, then they're going to watch it, and then they're going to tell others to watch it. It doesn't matter if you don't have some big international star in it. So long as you keep people interested, that's the main thing.
Or sometimes you can bring an older actor in, you know, hasn't acted for a while, you know, mm-hmm. and those people are really good, you know, still.
That's it. Yeah. Here I've got a bit of reputation that I'll give an unknown a part in it, but for the Uninvited Spirit, they're all, well, I'm telling a lie, there's actually one of the actors in it. This is the third film that he's done with me. And because I know him, he knows how I work. And he is a good actor. But the rest of them, they were all, the main actress, well, put it this way, the lead actor in it, never done a film before. He's actually a singer.
Okay.
But he went to acting college like for 4 years,
uh-huh.
But then he concentrated on his singing.
And being a singer, you know, you're the front man and you have to learn how to entertain, you know.
But it turned out, I mean, it was great because he was used to being in front of a camera.
Right.
And it turned out he is a really good actor as well.
Mm-hmm.
The lead actress, she'd done a couple of shorts, but again, turned out really good.
And yourself being a director and a writer, you know, and acting, so you know what you're looking for.
Yeah, I mean, I like to, I hate to bandy about names, but when I worked in Braveheart, Mel Gibson,
mm-hmm.
I remember something that he told me. He never auditions anyone. What he does, he looks at the photographs, he looks at the showreels, and then he'll invite them out for, like, lunch. And he'll sit there and he'll chat away for them and lunch. Nothing about the film, just a general chat.
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, how are you? He says, because when people go for an auditions, they're like robots, which is true. They have a line to say. They walk into a room, there's a camera sitting there, a couple of people sitting at a desk, and maybe another actor there that you can bounce your lines off. You say your line, your name, your agent, your line, and then it's, okay, we'll let you know, out the door. Someone else can run, does the same thing. You don't know anything about that person. Whereas if you invite them out and you're sitting there having lunch and you're talking about every day in general, you're learning the personality of that person. You're learning if you can work with that person, if he can work with you. And you're learning, like, judging their character and everything. And that's what I do now. It's a great way of doing things. So that way, when we come to go on set, there's no sort of prima donnas. You don't get any big argument because you already know that you can work with these people.
I like that. I like that theory. I like that.
Yeah. I would rather have, like, a happy set. Everybody enjoying herself and they're not all, I mean, as I say, have the one rotten egg, the one bad tomato in the set that spoils it for everyone. So, and the only way to get around that is if you meet them first and you sit and you have a chat with them and you learn about them, and then that way you can say to yourself, I can work with this person, or you can say to yourself, well, nah, there's something about them that I don't trust or I don't like, I'll try the next one. And that's the way I do it. It maybe cost me a wee bit more buying lunch all the time, but in the end up, you end up with a good crew. I tend to work with the same crew all the time. because they know how I work. I know how they work.
Well, that's good. Mm-hmm.
I never went to directing school. I just learned it sort of when I was on set all the time.
Uh-huh.
And they say I'm a pretty fast director. I don't do 10 or 12 takes. And then when it comes to the editing, probably the second or third one's the best one. I think normally I'll do maybe about 3 or 4 takes. And if I think it's all right and it looks good, then we move on to the next scene.
I'll be right back with the rest of my conversation with Bill Little right after these brief messages.
I know when I did my documentary, I went into a modeling agency close to me in Ohio. And I knew kind of what I wanted for I had like 6 different mini shows in my documentary. And so I knew what I wanted for each show. And I was expecting maybe 10 or 12 actors to show up, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, I went there, and I'm standing in the line outside this agency, you know. And there's like 150 people in line. I'm thinking,
yeah,
man, I'm going to be here all day waiting to get in there to do my auditioning. Here the owner of the agency came out. She says, hey, Al, they're here to see you.
Yeah.
And I was like, say what, you know. You know, and all these people, they just needed their small parts, but they needed to put for the resume, you know.
Yeah.
And I didn't know this. That was all new to me, you know.
Right.
And I was and I'm going home with a folder with 300 to 500 headshots of people's experience. I'm like, wow, you know. And
it down takes a time.
And you're right. Some of these people that weren't well known, didn't have half the experiences like some of the other ones. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones I was looking for.
Well, I mean, the ones I hate are the ones that turn up and they say, I've got an HND. I went to college for 4 years. I done it. And I sit there and I say to them, listen, as far as I'm concerned, that's just a certificate. It's just a bit of paper. All it tells me is you went to college, mm-hmm. acting school for like 4 years. But that doesn't mean to say the person off the street that's never done any acting in their life isn't as good an actor as you, or even a better actor. And the example I give them will say, look at one of the most famous Scottish actors that ever was Sean Connery.
Right, exactly.
He was a milkman and a bodybuilder, never done any acting.
Right, to me, probably the best James Bond, you know.
Yeah, I still think he's the best.
You know,
yeah.
He's done some of the other probably better even roles, but James Bond, to me, to my wife, has always been Sean Connery, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it's life experience. That's what acting is. It's life experience. I mean, if you've done a lot of things or you've been around, then that's, I mean, because as an actor, the character you take on, part of that character comes from within you. So part of it is you. And if you've got a lot of life experience and all that, you can bring that onto the screen. It's up to the director to get that out of you.
Downton Abbey.
Yeah.
Those actors were, I don't know who did the casting of that, but they did a great job.
I tend to, when I write a script, I'll write a description of each character. And to save all this, like you're saying, 150-odd people, what I do, when I advertise that we're looking for cast, I'll put the description in the cast. But you always get people turn up that don't fit the description.
Yeah, that was my first time out, and I didn't. I would have definitely did that the second time out. Yeah. You know,
well, normally, I'll look at the photos, and I'll normally try and get people as close to the description as I can. I work it right down to them, and then I'll look at their showreels and see what their acting's like. Mm-hmm. And then after that, you whittle that back down again, and then you end up with maybe only about 20 people or something. And that's the ones that you invite out, and then it's to see their personality and their character. And that's the way I do it.
And it helps you too, you know, with you being a director and being in the business, you know, like you said, you know, you work with the same people, like say your lighting crew or your makeup,
lighting,
you know,
sound guy,
the costumes, you know, you know the people you want to work with, you know, that you're comfortable with, that it can work well with you.
Yeah. I mean, there is a couple of actors that I try and sort of fit in. I'll write a character with them in mind, because I know that I've worked with them before and I like them or they like me. I know what they bring to the screen. So sometimes I'll write a character with them in mind, so I don't have to audition for that part because I know they will do the part.
Uh-huh.
But for other characters, it's just a case of your own judgment. Plus the fact that also, if you invite them out, it also lets them know if they can work with you.
Right, right. You know, and that's the key. I mean, like I said before, the key is, you know, you wrote the show, you wrote the movie, so you know what you're... what's your vision in your mind when you wrote that thing?
Yeah.
So when you are also blessed to be the director, so I think that's really that's cool, you know, because you know exactly what you want, and I think you know right off the bat if you're going to hit it or not, what you're looking for.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, that's it in a T. You wrote it. You know what you're looking for, and. Well, you're hoping you get what you're looking for, but you can reduce that risk.
Right, right. And the risk, my risk also is in making this one documentary. It's like, I'm so blessed that I wasn't sued, you know? No, really. I mean, I had one of my actors on a railroad train, on a railroad track, you know, and the story was this because it was all paranormal. So the story was he was just going to walk down this track, right? Mm-hmm. But his thing was, he keeps ending up in the same spot. He's going in one direction, and the train, and it's not a circle track. I mean, the track goes from almost 400 miles. So it's so, but he, after 10 minutes, he's always back at the same spot.
Yeah.
You know, so I had him on this train track, and I asked the people that live in that area, is there any trains, active trains on tape that are
late
on a Sunday morning here and coming around the bend. And I have the cameras, everything set up on the track. And he turned around. I says, just turn around and look at me at the camera like you're shocked that you see something coming. Well, I heard this rumbling, but I always thought it was like a car going by us with a big loud sound system, you know. I turned around, here comes a freaking train. You know, so I had to jump off the track, and I'm praying to God that my actor jumped off the train track. And
I hope you kept the cameras rolling to get the train.
I did, and I lost that section.
Oh, you're joking.
But I did get the train coming by. But the, and I'm thinking my actor got killed.
Oh.
You know?
Yeah.
Then after the train went by, that's what I did get. Then he comes walking out of the woods. My heart was in my throat because I thought the train hit him. You know, and I'm like, oh, you know, like I said, I'm so thankful I was not sued. Don't like maybe three or four of those scenes, you know. But you know, you have to look at all that when you're making a movie, you know.
Oh yeah, you do. I mean,
and I'm sure you've had some experiences
where
you have to can be concerned about your actors and actresses, you know.
But that's how I like it. If I wrote it and I'm directing it, things can change when you're on set, depending on what happens. I mean, when we were doing Train to Kill, we were doing a set down at the walkway at the river, and across the other side, it's like the helicopter base with the ambulance, police helicopters, ambulance helicopters. And we were doing this scene, and it was quite a sad scene, and I could see this helicopter, the blades going on it. It was starting up, so I thought, oh, so I said, just take a break, everybody, have a coffee break. So the cameraman said, but you don't want to finish this scene? I said, no, just have a coffee break now. I says, but keep your camera pointing on that helicopter. He said, what? We don't have a helicopter in it. I said, yeah, but we might do later. I said, what? And it was great because when the helicopter took off, it flew right across us, right across the top of us, and we got all that. We got the whole thing, we got all the footage. And we actually did, we didn't use it in that film, but we used that footage in another film.
Oh, yeah, you can always use that as a stock footage, you know.
Mm. And the same with the Extreme Justice, right at the very beginning, we're shooting a scene where they're throwing a dead body into the river. And just before they went to throw, we rehearsed it, and we could hear the splash, splash of the river. So what's that? And we looked around. I know how you get these... they're out rowing, they're rowing the boat. Racing boats they use.
Right.
And they were practicing, and they came right past where we were, and I said to them, right, wait. So Mark says, see when that comes up, I'll tell you when. I says, and just follow them with the camera. And he did, and we actually put that in the scene where they're throwing the boat. We actually said to the actors, right, look, just as you're ready to throw that in, you'll see this canoe or this boat, whatever it is, coming up. pull the body back out, hide behind the hedges, and then when the boat was away, come back out and throw it in. Then, I mean, that was never written. That wasn't in that scene at all. But it made the scene better because we had these, and the rowers, probably to this day, they don't even know that they're on set. They're on, they go and watch this film, and they'll be like, hey, that's me.
Right, right, right. You're asking me, well, did you keep the film, did you keep it running while that guy, while the train was, while the thing was, my back was to the train, so the camera's facing the other way. And it's coming down so fast on me. I'm talking about maybe 100 yards. And it came around a corner because we're right on the train, the bend of the tracks, right? Mm-hmm. So the train's coming around a corner, and I didn't have much time to get off that track with my camera. I had the tripods up on the camera and the lighting and the microphones. So I had to make sure I grabbed my equipment. Yeah. So that was me getting my equipment off the track before the train. And I just did, you know, just enough time to get off that track. So also when I got off the track and the train's already gone by and it's got the whistle blowing, and I just happened to look up and I couldn't see the actor. You know, so my thought was it hit the actor, you know, because I said, just turn around, act like you're scared and start running. Well, he did, but he's actually looking at the train behind me coming.
So it was real.
So it was real, right? You're right. And so I had the person that lived next to the track come out, and she says, oh my God, there has never been a train on this track in the 10 years I lived here on a Sunday morning. So they don't run on Sundays, you know. I said, okay, you know. I contacted the company. They said, no, there was no train that day.
Huh?
You know. So no. So I'm like, this whole thing was just so weird, you know.
Oh, that's weird.
Right, right. You know, it was just a silly story that I was doing about a guy walking on the same track, you know. But it was, you know, what I'm saying, you know, like behind the scenes. Yeah. So I wanted to do it like a DVD. Because the movie first came out on VHS. So I wanted to do like a DVD version, which I did, and do like behind the scenes. I still one of these days might want to go back and look at something that was done like 20 years ago, 25 years ago to redo that, you know. Because it sold pretty well. I mean, enough to make my money back, you know. But
I always do the bloopers.
The bloopers, you're right. Parts. Right, right.
I always do a trail of
video. I love those. I love the bloopers. Yeah.
Some of them are brilliant. And I always put them up on YouTube, like, for people to watch. And some of the comments you get for it are better than the comments you get for the actual film.
Right. Do you ever do, like, two endings, like two different endings? Go with one or go with the other ending?
Yeah. Mm. See which one.
And that leaves you. Leaves even the cast guessing. Yeah. You know.
But I'm really. I mean, I've got another three scripts that I wrote, so hopefully, it's worked for the next couple of years.
Wish you the best. You know, I'm gonna keep updated with you and get you back on the show again.
Yeah, that would be good. If this distribution company, if they take this, then I'll let you know. And I'll let you know, I can send a link to you.
Yeah. Send me the link and, you know. And
viewers can watch it.
Right, exactly.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'll put it onto our social media pages as well. That gives you a bit of publicity as well, the podcast. But it was nice talking to you.
Thank you, Bill Little. It was my pleasure having you on the show today, and I'm going to put all of Bill's links at the bottom of this episode. He's phenomenal. Actor, director, stuntman. His resume is a mile long. It was a thrill having him on. I look forward to having him on again in the future. This is the last episode of 2024. I can't believe it. Man, it's been a very interesting year. 2025, I start my 7th season. Yes, unbelievable. 7 seasons. And I'm so, so grateful. I'm approaching 100,000 downloads. I truly appreciate every single one of you for listening to the stories, to my guests. If you have anything you want to share, come on the show, a podcast, a book, a story, whatever you have that's paranormal. And you can go to my website, authoralcooley.com. That's in the show notes also. If you'd like to pick up my book, it's available at my website and also on Amazon or any place you get your books. Spencer's Ghosts. It's my first novel. I am truly blessed. I appreciate, like I said, I appreciate every single one of you. Please have a safe, happy holiday, and we'll rock this thing again next year. Peace.
Peace out. I'm your host, Al Cooley, Ghost in the Valley Podcast.